Gutevach. As I mentioned last week, the Psay community was zocha to a number of firsts. The first that they were zocha to is that this is the first community that we're doing this program for a community. In the past, we've done it for yeshivas, kolel and smicha programs, which we still plan to do. But as far as a community is concerned, so Psay was zocha to be the first one. The second first is this evening. We've never before attempted to have a panel such as this with eight experts from the OU. And the reason we did it is it's interesting that in the OU we have, I think, over 50, which are called in the OU RCs, which refers to rabbinic coordinators. And they manage the company and everything to do with the company that they're involved with, Gashmias, Baruchmias. So Brooklyn, everybody understands, would be the lead place where RCs come. But the second is not Muncie, it's not Lakewood. The second to Brooklyn is the city of Passaic. So we thought it would be very interesting to have the eight RCs from Passaic give a short discussion. And it's very daring because it's like teaching the Torah Regel Achas. They have to summarize their expertise, their field, in between 10 to 15 minutes. So because we want to stay to our schedule, finishing approximately 10 o'clock. And the format will be that we will have four presentations. After the four presentations, we'll have a chance for questions and answers. The way we do it, everyone has next to them an index card, if you could write your question down on the index card. If you know the name of the rabbi that you're addressing the question to, or at least the industry, will figure out who the rabbi is that you're addressing the question to, and then he will answer that question. And then at the end of the evening, again, we'll have the last four presentations, and once again, we'll have a question and answer session. I'd like to introduce the panel, with the exception of Rabbi Paretsky, who is a senior RC. He's a group leader as well. He's been at the OU for over 20 years, so we felt that he deserves to be Rosh Harishon, L'chol Davar Sheva Kedusha. So he's first to my left, and afterwards we are going in alphabetical order. Next to him, to his right, is Rabbi Elio Farrell, whose expertise is chemicals. Rabbi Eli Gersten, to the right of Rabbi Farrell, is Rabbi Eli Gersten, who is the RC in charge of OU Psak and Policy, which means that we have two poskim primarily. We have a third also, Rabbi Ganak, is like a Besdin. We have Rabbi Yisrael Belsky Shlita, Rabbi Hershel Schechter Shlita, and Rabbi Menachem Ganak Shlita. And the OU policy is formulated through a discussion by the poskim on any given topic. Rav Belsky comes in every Thursday, Rav Schechter comes in every Friday, and if there's some major thing where psak has to be discussed, they come together, and through Rabbi Ganak as well, the final OU policy is formulated, and it is all written down. Today we don't write, we do everything with computers. So all the tshuvas, thousands of tshuvas, are written in Lashon Kodesh, in English, and with a touch of a button on any given subject, in a few seconds, you can have all the OU tshuvas on that particular subject. So Rabbi Gersten works with the poskim what the Gemara calls the Safra Dedina, to record all of these psakim. To his right is Rabbi David Gorelick, who has a number of fields, jams, jellies, nuts, but he's going to speak specifically tonight about the Isser of Yashan. To my right is Rabbi Yitzhak Gutterman, who's going to speak about refined oils, and you have a colored pictures that he will be discussing in his presentation. To his right is Rabbi David Jenkins, who works for the new company division. When a company wants to become OU certified, they go to a part of the OU that is called the new company division. Rabbi Jenkins has many years of expertise and experience in the field of kashrus. He's been involved in many kashrus organizations in the Midwest, And we're very fortunate to have him join our staff, and he's going to tell us how Tootsie Roll became OU certified. To his right is Rabbi Mordechai Merzel, who will be discussing dairy issues. And to his right is Rabbi Gavriel Price. He will be discussing ingredient research, every ingredient that comes into the OU system, the database of accepted OU ingredients for all their products is reviewed. He's part of the review team, and he's going to give us an example in a few minutes of a Shiloh that recently appeared on the horizon, the status of papaya and its derivatives in Chutz La'aretz. So they'll just give you all of these presentations are samples of what the 50 Rabbanim are involved in, but the main thing is, I think you'll appreciate that on every area, the OU has a mahalach, it has its poiskim, it has its psak piske halacha, and it is these rabbis who make sure that the psakim that the OU poiskim tell us to follow is implemented in the companies that they are in charge of. Without further ado, I'd like to call on the first speaker this evening, Rabbi Yisrael Peretzky, who will discuss industrial kashrus and the baking industry. Rabbi Yisrael.
A little shorter. Thank you, Rabbi Grossman. This time, Rabbi Grossman spared me. Generally, when he introduces me as the head of the baking division, which I always tell him translates at the Sarah Open. And in a few weeks, we'll learn that he didn't fare so well. Hagon Rav Meir Shapira Zatzal, upon founding his famed yeshiva Chachmei Lublin, was asked what the derech of his yeshiva will be. He said, "I don't want to give the talmidim finished rolls. I want to teach them how to bake the rolls. You all enjoy baked products. In the few minutes that I have, we'll try to show you, pardon the pun, give you a little taste of the baked products." First, let's define the terms. What's the sugya? It's industrial kashrus baking. The truth is there are two totally separate divisions. The first area of industrial baking are industrial bakeries. They bake baked goods, no different than your local retail bakery, all the different baked goods. What's the difference? The difference is in the size and the scope of the operation. And this obviously affects the hashkocha, for good and for bad. Let me give you just a few examples. I was at a bagel factory upstate New York that produced 30,000 bagels per hour, a little more than Bagel Munch, even on a busy day. There's companies that produce 10,000 pies per shift. I was at a cookie company that recently closed, as a matter of fact. It was a landmark. That was 1 million square feet, just to give you a feel. If you were at Rabbi Perlmutter's presentation last week, he spoke of the oven alone at Nabisco, which is well over 300 feet. These companies have hundreds and hundreds of ingredients of every type of ingredient. This difference affects kashrus. On one hand, it's easier in a larger bakery. Things are computerized, they're orderly. In a certain sense, it's easier to have control of the massive ingredients, especially systems of dairy power. In a small bakery, things are all on top of each other. The ingredients can come in small quantities in the middle of the night, so it's harder in that sense. It certainly is harder to have dairy power. I'm not going to say, but generally speaking, a very small bakery, it's very hard to have dairy power controlled properly. Obviously, the flip side is that the hashkocha required in a major facility requires a lot of expertise. There's a lot of technical know-how a mashgiach has to know, and we indeed have an OU. We produce the baking mashgiach manual. We have a lot of checklists and a lot of instructions to guide a mashgiach through the complications of an industrial bakery. But the major portion, people don't realize, of the baking industry is the bakery supply companies. There are very few borim anymore, very few people that create yesh meyayin. Even the bakers, certainly the in-store, but even the regular bakers, get pre-ingredients and they go on. Everything's fast-paced. Very few bake from scratch anymore. And that's where most of the industrial baking companies are. They produce basically three chalakim. Dry mixes, which are then further used by the baker or the consumer. Doughs, frozen doughs, which have to be baked. And fillings, the whole industry producing pie fillings for the or fillings, not just for pie, for various baked items. There are major companies that do that. That has its own set of issues, not like rest of baking, because often there'll be, let's say, cream cheese filling, and there'll be a need to do a proper hangola in the kettles between the fillings. Even something as Hamish as a challah, there are mixes for. In fact, there was a bakery, and I knew about it. I enjoyed the challahs myself. Everybody marveled at the recipe of the baker. The truth is, what was good about it is that he used a industrial bake mix, actually from a company in under the OU in New Jersey, not far from here. L'umazeh, and the reason I say this story, a good chaver of mine, actually a chassidus sharav, that grew up yesteryear in Los Angeles, before Los Angeles had its kailos, and it was a little different then. There was there a bakery where everybody enjoyed the challahs. To the shock of the community, they discovered the reason was because the baker had this concoction basically made out of dairy ingredients that gave it its taste. The truth of the matter is, in the baking industry, and especially bread, baking manners would tell you that dairy ingredients have a lot of purposes. Taste, preservative, as a dough condition, also helps the crema saponim, the crust. So it is an issue. Actually, it's a bit less of an issue in these days. Because of allergen concerns, companies are going away, and therefore there's more chance in general for us to get paraf. They're doing away. They're trying to do away. A new issue to be aware on the rise, especially in dark breads, is the use of raisin juice concentrate increasingly. And raisin juice concentrate is a major problem. The way it's produced now, we feel, has the same issue as grape juice, which would mean it's tam yenum, and it would have to be under hashgachat tzmitus. And there are very few, actually, raisin juice concentrates that are certified acceptably as kosher. Dough. The next thing is the frozen doughs. I always get this question, and in fact, I got it this week from a Rav. Let's say you buy the frozen challah. They're very popular, the pie doughs that people buy. Is it pas yisrael? Well, the answer is I don't know. It depends who's going to bake it. Is flour pas yisrael? The frozen doughs that you get are not baked. They're frozen dough. They're yisur, the doughs that are frozen. They're not yet baked. The whole issue of pas yisrael comes to the fore by the afir. Whole halachic issues, the beginning of the baking, the end, but it has to be the baking. These doughs are frozen. There are some that are slightly par-baked, but they're certainly not baked. But the frozen pies, they're not baked at all. They're frozen dough. There's no issue with pas yisrael. If you will bake, it'll be pas yisrael. If a woman will buy a frozen challah dough and she bakes it, she'll have challahs for Shabbos. And even according to those who want to be machmer, that the lechomim of Shabbos should be pas yisrael, she'll have them. If she wants to also have the thing that is brought down in the Rashi in Masechet Shabbos based on a medrash that the dinyan of a woman being mafresh challah to make up for the chetz, then she should make her own dough. But the pas yisrael will be. This is the opposite of the case. We always get the question, next question, if frozen dough under there, do I have to take challah or not? The answer is no. Why not? One of two reasons. Either the company that made this dough was non-Jewish, in which case there's no chiyuv challah. The chiyuv of challah comes at the shasa isa, except in rare exceptions by loose batter, blila raka, blila ova. Rashi's Avraham said that's the definition of the mechayev of challah, and if it's isas goy, is not chayev in challah, and it's not a heter. That's the halacha. There's no chumrah. There's nothing you're gaining. It's meaningless to take challah from an isas nochri. If it was a Jew, no different than any baked item, the OU, as well as any reliable Hashgach agency, I would hope, would already make sure to be mafresh challah. We don't, again, yesteryear, there were Hashgachas that would give Hashgach, but you have to take challah. We don't feel that's right. If you're giving Hashgach, we don't expect the person to then, well, I can't eat it because it's several, I have to do something else. How challah is taken is a very complicated matter, because in industrial settings, it's not always easy to have someone be mafresh from Jew from every Issa. We have a very complicated system worked out the halacha to the T. And other agencies may have other systems. I would point out two quick things. Number one, even a small bakery that's Jewish owned, you would think doesn't need a system. You should look into that. Because even a Jewish bakery, where a baker doesn't mean the Jew is there all night when the non-Jewish baker says, so still a system will have to be worked out by the Rav HaMachshir. It's not for sure that he's going to be there by every Issa. In addition, when we say Jewish owned for challah, it's very interesting. How much flour do you need to make challah? So let's take a lot of shittas. Let's say 3 pounds is the normal assumption, correct? How much Jewish ownership does there have to be to be chayav challah? It depends. All the, you have to have Jewish ownership that has a chayav challah. So therefore, in a big company, like that bagel company I was talking about, they may have batches of dough that use 30 pounds of flour. So then, if the Jewish ownership is as little as even 10%, 10% of 30 pounds is 3 pounds, so it would be a chiyuv challah. So it could be a lot less than full Jewish ownership for us to have to deal with the issue of challah, depending, of course, on the size. In industrial settings, the size of batches are often very big. We mentioned the story in Los Angeles. That he fooled people. But even if he didn't fool people, you know the halacha, dairy bread is awesome. Even if he said it was dairy, we can't have OUD bread. That's a halacha. It's the last tzimin in the Hilchos Pasuk B'chol, tzimin sadezayin, based on the Gemara Pesachim. It's also to knead, to lolish, to bake, and to eat dairy bread. Fleishik bread, too. That's not so common. Why am I mentioning this? Obviously, that's the halacha. The OU doesn't allow it. I want to mention 2 points. There were some ashgachas. There is a whole sugi of Ke'en Tura, which then developed on it. Some said that if you imprint some Shinui Tsuya or some sort of dairy symbol in the bread, some wanted to say that the D symbol on the package of packaged bread would suffice. We've never accepted that, and therefore we can't have dairy bread. The fact that it says OUD on the label will be not acceptable. We also, now, the Iser begins at the dough. So we mentioned our frozen doughs. Certainly they can't be milchik if they're challah, if they're bread doughs, as well as frozen baked breads. What about bakery mixes? I said that was a big part of the industry. That would mean technically, according to the halacha, we should be able to certify dairy bread mixes. And there are a lot of companies that make them, and there are a lot of companies that want us to make them. And we have lost companies because we will not do it. Other agencies have done it. We've been working with them. We've convinced some not. We're not happy to lose it. And more important, we're not happy because we feel it's a milchah. What do we mean? Rabbi Yonak has always said. So we're Yotzei Zayin. We put an OUD on a white bread mix and we didn't do anything wrong, right? What is the point of that action? You're going to take the OUD bread mix, either a consumer or a baker, and say, well, the OU said it's kosher, right? I'm going to do what I have to do, what I'm going to do. I'm going to knead it and bake it, which is awesome. So we're providing a milchah. We're Yotzei Zayin. We did nothing less. So therefore, we will not do it. We would think it's a steer to give a hefsher, which by definition creates a milchah. Since I mentioned Pasas Ra, I'll mention it very briefly. I won't go into the details. I always say these things, and it sounds funny, but it's the truth. The OU is both Mekel and Machmer. We're Mekel. Most, as you know, OU items are not Pasas. We're relying on the Shittas HaRamot. The Mekomos, it was because of Chai Nefesh, it was not Mispasha, and we don't claim it's Pasas Ra. There's a number of items that are, and they are clearly marked. The reason I say that we're Machmer, to some extent, the reason is, in an industrial setting, it's often very hard to have actual Pasas Ra. A Jew light the fire all the time, and there are different methods. Many agencies, and they have Sukkim, and there are Puskim that say it. I can't make a way, but we don't accept it. Have methods that are easy, certain heating elements, certain glow bars that are put in, and they would consider that like the Hecker of Kisei. Our Puskim, for various reasons, do not consider that acceptable. Whatever we do, we have various methods. It has to be something affecting the fire itself. And therefore, that's one of the reasons we're limited. If we weren't so limited, perhaps there would be more possible, but we do have an amount. One of the two last things, we mentioned Jewish-owned bakeries. Another area of bread, of baked items, obviously in Jewish-owned bakery creates a problem. Pesach, and here too, we're different. There are a lot of agencies that have certain coolers. Again, they have basis in halacha of selling, not selling the chametz, they'll work out entire sale of the company. We do not, and we have lost many companies because we want them to be closed. If you take a non-religious Jew and tell him he has to be closed for 8 days, it's hard to convince him. I've convinced, but they don't always want to do it. Just this Friday, before leaving the office, I followed from the early morning to the end, among other things that I did. We included a company that's going to be leaving us because he just refuses to do that. And by the end of March, he'll use up his labels. He's a Jewish-owned company. He said, I will not close for Pesach. So we'll part ways. I just want to conclude before the buzzer goes off for Rabbi Grossman. You, and we have to demand of the Hashgacha the most. It's our job. We have to do what we can do. But I always say, Hashgacha needs the Hashgacha. We need the Siyata Dishmaya. Without the Siyata Dishmaya, despite all our good efforts, we're lost. At the end of the day, we need that hashgacha. I want to just say that we're dealing with Timtum Alev. It's not just anything. Timtum Alev counted from Nefashas Yisrael. The fifth slide, of course, of being Mezakeh counts from Nefashas Yisrael. I know I am, and I suppose my colleagues are, I'm a spiral every day in the office, I think at least, of the Tzvila of Rav Nechunya ben Akona, Shelo Yera Dvar Takola Yodenu, and that we should have the Siyata Deshmaya, that we should be Masliach in our avodah to be Mezakeh the Rabbin with Macholos Ksheiros. Thank you.
Rabbi Peretzky, the challahs are very delicious. Somebody said maybe Rabbi Peretzky should speak the whole night. But I don't know if the next subject is a schmuck that's chemicals, but I'm sure Rabbi Perel will make it very interesting for us. A great cover to introduce Rabbi Elio Perel speaking on chemicals.
I really have to start with an apology. I'm very much not prepared. The reason for that, when Reb Grossman asked me to speak about chemistry, I thought it was for the Shalom Bias seminar tonight. And I walked in, and it's kashrus. So bear with me. I'm going to wing it. Hopefully. Okay. The first thing. No, sorry, just kidding. Okay. Typically, in the field, we don't talk so much about chemicals. That's more of a popular term. Typically, what we talk about is what's known as a chemical substance. A chemical substance refers to either a pure element, such as gold, silver, aluminum, things like that. Or a pure compound, such as water, which is made up of hydrogen and oxygen, or salt, which is made up of sodium and chloride, either a pure element or a pure compound, one or the other. That's what we refer to as a chemical substance. Chemical, the word chemical is more of a noun that's used in industries, but I don't know if chemists themselves really use that word so much. It shouldn't come as a big surprise that in the industry, both in the laboratories for pure science and as well as the food production, pharmaceuticals, what they do all the time is chemical reactions. What's a chemical reaction? Well, a chemical reaction is when you take one or more chemical substances and you transform them on the molecular level. Okay, it's much more than just the physical change of, let's say, adding salt to pepper, where if you had the right equipment, you could physically pick apart the salt and the pepper, or if you mix up iron filings with talcum powder with a magnet, you could physically remove the iron from the talcum powder. When we talk about a chemical reaction, we're not talking about these kind of mere physical changes, but a chemical reaction is when you are transforming one or more chemical substances into one or more other chemical substances. But on the molecular level, or even on the atomic level, in other words, you're talking about an actual physical change in the structure of the atoms and/or molecules themselves. Sometimes a chemical reaction will be used to turn one substance into two. Sometimes you'll be turning two into one. Sometimes the way you do this is you take a substance and you react it with another substance. Sometimes you'll take a substance and you react it with energy, such as heat. It's already here that kashrus issues already start. The things that you're reacting, not surprisingly, are called reactants. You want to make sure your reactants are kosher approved, kosher friendly. If the energy that you're reacting the substance with is heat, obviously the heat is going to have a heat source. So already that you have issues of, you want to make sure that your equipment is kosher friendly once you're applying heat. You can pretty much count on the fact that in a sophisticated chemical production facility, they're going to be very strict about cleanliness. So you're not going to have to worry about, chazushmalts, smeared on the surface of the chemical reactor. But if they had a non-kosher friendly reactant and they used heat, and then your kosher certified product is going to be on that same reactor with the same heat, then you're raising the specter of a potential kosher problem. So in these reactions, so sometimes they will apply heat, as I mentioned, to speed up the rate of the reaction, and heat is always a red flag in the kosher world because of the capacity of heat to render items non-kosher. Sometimes to increase the rate of a chemical reaction, they'll introduce a catalyst just to make the reaction go faster. Some catalyst enzymes are one on that list of potential catalysts. Enzymes also are a kosher red flag. Enzymes are grown on what's called a substrate. Okay, there are, Rabbi Price will correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, they have a substance, they introduce a microorganism, that microorganism consumes and converts that substrate into an enzyme, potentially. It could be other things too, but in our case, an enzyme. So if your substrate is not kosher, I mean, you're going to raise kosher questions with your enzyme, and that will raise kosher questions with any chemical reaction you're doing with that enzyme. So these are already some of the things that are on our minds when chemical companies come to be certified, or if presently certified companies want to add products to their line of already certified products, that we always want to know, okay, let's talk about, you know, the things that are involved, the heat, and let's talk about catalysts, things like that. Of course, the reactants themselves, as I mentioned, also, of course, have to be kosher. So, chemical engineers work with food scientists to produce food-related items. One of the things they do is they try and create these additives which enhance what's called mouthfeel. Mouthfeel, as you probably can guess, is when you put the food in your mouth, how does it feel? Does it feel good, not good, soft, hard? These are things that go into marketing. You know, the mouthfeel additive may not do anything for the nutrition, and perhaps not even for the taste, but it'll feel better in your mouth. And that comes from the marriage, getting back to Shalom Bias, that comes from the marriage of the chemical engineers with the food scientists, trying to produce something that'll enhance mouthfeel or texture or appearance. Again, you know, we're not, I can speak for myself and so could my internist, we're not, you know, beings who rely, who make their food decisions based only on nutritional value. That's important and it's a nice thing. And they have additives that increase that, that enhance that as well. But a lot of our decisions on what to eat are built on texture and appearance. If it looks nicer, I want to eat it more than I will want to eat something that's less attractive in appearance. And so the chemical engineers are getting together with the food scientists to create all these kind of substances and additives which will basically make you want to buy the food more, and as a side benefit, perhaps also increase its nutritional value, but they are not necessarily focused on that. So when we stick, you know, as a youth, there was this game that I used to play with my father, Oliver Shalom, 20 questions. I don't know if they still play it. I never saw my kids play it, but it was a 20 question. The first question of the person would, one of the players would think of a person or a thing, and you had 20 questions to identify it. So the first question always was, is it animal, vegetable, or mineral? So in Yiddishkeit, you know, we talk about at least four classes of being. We talk about domain, which is the minerals, and the tzomeach, which are the vegetable. And whereas in the majority culture, everything above the vegetables was animal. It could be, you could be thinking of the president. Well, let's not go there. You could be thinking of your cousin Tilly. And that would, in the 20 questions, that would be animal. Of course, we separate. We say there's bal chai, there's animals, and then there's medaber, there's human beings. And I think Rav Hirsch would add the fifth one, that there's Yisrael. But we're not going to go there either, because this is going to be on the internet, perhaps. So, once we are in the realm of the minerals, so then we're not really so worried about kashrus, obviously. There are a few treif rocks out there. And when we move to vegetables, again, the questions begin to pop up. Again, not very, very many. I mean, on a kind of a basic level, you know, we would be concerned, let's say, if the vegetables, the botanicals were coming from Israel, and there would be might be issues of Shemitah or Orla or Tumis and Maestris. But again, that's very, very rare. Alcohol raises an issue. You know, alcohol is also created by fermentation. You know, the microorganisms are introduced to the carbohydrates in, let's say, fruits such as grapes, typically, right? Wine. When we're making wine or grape juice, we're introducing microorganisms into the grapes. The microorganisms are consuming and converting the carbohydrates in the grape to, you know, the wine. Okay, so that already, again, that's going to raise a red flag. Alcohol raises a red flag for that reason, that when we talk about wine, we have to talk already about Stam Yeinam. That's the wine that Chazal forbade us to have. And Yein Nesek doesn't come up too much in Kashrus. But Stam Yeinam, that specter always does kind of rear its head. So when we think about alcohol, that's something that's on the radar. Again, is every single case or even most cases going to have that problem? No, but it's on the radar. It's on the radar, the issue of Stam Yeinam, that if there's a fermentation of grapes into wine or vinegar as well, then already that's something that's going to be kind of playing handball on the back of our heads to make sure that that's no issue. Where we really get into problems, and potentially very big problems, is when we move past mineral, past vegetable, to animal, to what we would call the balei chai. There's a class of chemicals known as the oleochemicals. These are chemicals derived from either oils or fats. Oils and fats can come from either vegetable or animal. Then you're really going to have tzaras in kashrus. Now, I'll give you some examples of the oleochemicals and some examples of where we run into it literally every day. Oils and fats are triglycerides. Triglycerides, I didn't give Rav Grossman a chart to hand out, but if you can just imagine a little bit. So triglycerides are where you have a molecule of glycerol, and then extending from it are three chains of fatty acids, hence triglycerides, tri-3. So you have three. What chemists can do is they can strip off one or two of these chains of fatty acids. So if they strip off one, that leaves you with a diglyceride. They strip off two, that's a monoglyceride. Now, so mono and diglycerides are very, very useful. And if you're talking about a derivation from animal, could be vegetable too, but if you're talking about animal-derived, you can get into some very serious kashrus problems. When would I use a mono and diglyceride? So they are used, for example, as emulsifiers. What's an emulsifier? Let's say you have two liquids which are immiscible. That is to say, they don't dissolve, they don't disperse one in the other, like water and oil. You take an emulsifier and you introduce it into, let's take our example, the water and oil. You introduce the emulsifier into the water and the oil, and they will mix together. It'll either be water and oil and water, whatever it's going to be. That's a technical question. But the emulsifier will help the two liquids that wouldn't merge together. It'll help them merge together. And it's extremely useful in food production. So you have mono and diglycerides being used in dough, potato chips, ice cream, margarine, chocolate. It comes up, so that's something that's very sensitive. That's something that's very, very much on the radar. Anytime a company applies to become OU and we see on the raw material list mono and diglyceride, that's a major red flag. That's something that's going to require special attention. Other examples of oleochemicals, these chemicals derived from fats or oils, let's say glycerin is an example. Methyl esters, fatty acids, fatty alcohols, these things are also potentially animal-derived and potentially very trafe. In fact, even let's say you'll shech the behema and you'll use its fat or its oil to create these glycerides or the diglycerides, or you use it to create the glycerin, but you may end up with something which is kosher but fleishik. So that's also going to be, even that's going to be a red flag, because if you want to make a par product, a dairy product, you know, I mean, you can fill in the rest of the sentence. I already had a fine.
I running out of time? This is the...
I think you ran out.
I ran out? Anyway, wish everyone shalom bayis, and thank you for listening, and have a good one. Thank Rev Burrell for making a topic that would not be interesting sound very interesting, and how it relates to everyday kashrus. Our next speaker is Rabbi Eli Gerstein. As we mentioned already, he's the Safra Dedaina at the OU, and he's going to present us an interesting, he told me in advance, a very interesting machlok as between our poskim and how it relates to everyday kashrus. Rabbi Gerstein.
Thank you, Rabbi Grossman, and Shostley's Kilo. Every kashrus agency has standards by which they follow. One would hope that those standards are based on Shulchan Aruch. Well, as we all know, how we interpret the Shulchan Aruch depends on which Rav we ask. And if you ask three rabbis a question, you're likely to get four answers. So, you know, how one determines which Hashkacha they plan on relying on, for the most part, depends on who those Rabbanim are that stand behind the Hashkacha. I was asked to speak about OU Psak and policy, so of course OU Psak and policy come back to Rabbi Yisrael Belsky, Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas, and Rav Herschel Schachter, the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva University. And those two are the OU poskim, and they, between the two of them, basically all the shilas are presented. They come up daily, many times a day. We have shilas at the OU. Sometimes they are what I would refer to as top-down shilas, the shilas that come before the fact, where they're brought to the poskim and they should be reviewed and we should come up with a consistent policy. And then there are shilas which are, you know, the bottom-up shilas. They come from in the field. These are things that went wrong or didn't go exactly as planned. And there's a mashgiach, and it's, you know, 10 o'clock at night, and he's at a facility, and he's supposed to be kashering, and there's no hot water there, and what is he supposed to do? And these are the types of shilas that come up as well. And everything needs, you know, mashgiach in the field at 10 o'clock at night, or at 2 in the morning for that matter, deserves an answer just as much as anybody else. And these are issues, of course, that come to that come up when discussing OU Psak and policy. In the first realm, and so when we talk about the, you know, what's called the top-down approach, so we try to have something, we try to come up with an approach with policies where everybody is included, where, what's called the lechatchila approach, where everything is, all considerations are taken, are considered. And we have to come up with something which is, this is the straight way to go. Now, of course, even in that, there's obviously room for different interpretations, and there are different approaches. And very often we have inconsistency. You know, we'll have disagreements between our poskim, and we have to have that resolved. The way we do that is, as Rabbi Grossman noted earlier, is that our very capable kashrus administrator, Rabbi Menachem Ganak, he's called in to referee, and it's his job to make somehow pshares between the two and to get them to come up with an OU policy. As far as the bottom-up approach, so I have to admit over there it could be a little bit wilder. Sometimes, depending on who they get, if they answer the question, most often, the first line of defense is they'll call the RC, whoever the rabbi is who's overseeing this project. He's going to be the first line of defense by that mashgiach, and you know, sometimes he doesn't have time to get hold of anybody else. It's going to be his decision at that time. Often they'll come, you know, the next week, and they'll present to Rabbi Belsky or Shech. They'll say, this was the issue. This is how it was resolved. This is what was done. You know, was that adequate? Was that, you know, it's That's the way it is, just like it is in life in general. That's the way shaylos come up. You know, sometimes you don't have time to get hold of your rav. You have to get hold of whoever you can. So, you know, but we try to come at the OU. We try to be consistent. So again, there will be inconsistencies in that sense because, you know, sometimes there are emergencies. But otherwise, we try to run a consistent operation. And to do that, because it's such a large operation, the OU literally has hundreds, if not thousands, of different mashkichim that work for them, and thousands of plants in 80 different countries all over the world. We have to get the word out as to what the OU policies are. And part of that goes to Rabbi Grossman of the Daf HaKashrus. He tries to spread the word to the different mashkichim in the field. I have an article which I write, which I try to summarize OU policies and to try to and try to get them out. One thing I hear from different people is, you know, they call up, they ask, what is the OU policy about such and such? And I tell them, and I send them a document about it, and they say, oh, that's wonderful. You know, the OU is so transparent about what they do. And they say, you know, other agencies are sometimes more reluctant to give up their sources, their rationale for what they do in general. And I think, I mean, part of it comes from the size of the OU. There's no secrets, because when you have such, when you have thousands of people working for you, it's impossible to keep a secret even if you wanted to. So, that being said, I also am told, Rabbi Ganak and Rabbi Elephant and the administrators at the OU, they have empowered me to give out any psukim that we have. And I get calls, again, daily from people from different kashrus agencies, even all the time. I have kashrus agencies call me. They say, what is the OU policy about such and such? What does Rebelski say? What does Reshef say to do? How do we deal with such and such a situation? The OU has dealt with everything. Anything that you can imagine in terms of kashrus has come up already and has been presented. Sometimes the answers are not as good as the questions. Okay, that might be true. But on the other hand, we have, we have precedent for, and when another agency is stuck, that's very often what they'll do is they'll call the OU and they'll ask, you know, what have we done? What has already been? What is the precedent for such a case? I don't need to describe the, how the milas of our poskim. I think these are names that stand for themselves. I think people know of Rebelski and Reshechter. They know that they're people who are sought after all over the world, from people all over the world, not just on kashrus, but on any mitzvah of halacha. These are people who are constantly sought after, and I know just how busy they are because I need to catch up with them too all the time. And shalos that come up during the week, as you mentioned, the Rav Schachter is in the office on Fridays, Rebelski comes on Thursdays, but shaylos don't only come up, they come up on a Matzah Shabbos too, they come up on a Tuesday, they come up on a Monday morning. And, we try to get hold of them, and, they're giving shir, they're in a meeting, they're, okay, they'll get back to you when they have a chance. I leave messages with them on their answering machines, maybe not every day, but several times a week. So, and I'm sure I'm not the only one doing so. I know there are tens of people who are hundreds of people who are doing the same. So, it is a very big privilege at the OU that we do have such big names, such big Talmid Chachamim that we go to for Pesachim. When I talk about this topic, so the question everybody always wants to know is, well, do they agree on things? Do they get along with each other? So, the truth is, they usually disagree. What I mean by that is they usually have different approaches to a question. When I come to them, I usually, like I mentioned beforehand, in the I call the top-down approach. We're coming to issue a, come up with a policy, so we'll discuss the question ahead of time. They'll usually have different approaches. So by that, that doesn't mean that they'll disagree as to what ultimately should be done, but it means that they have usually different ways of getting there. We'll have some complicated question about how to kasher some situation. The issue was like this, and they whatever the case was, and depending on the kli that was used, nine times out of ten, they'll both come to the same conclusion. They'll both say, okay, it should be kashered with Hagala or with Limukal or whatever the method is. But for two different reasons. They come from different approaches. And it's very common. I mean, it's common if anybody has asked the different Rabbanim Mishailo, they also, it's a common thing. It's a certain, I guess, Siyata Deshmaya that Kadosh Baruch Hu gives to a Paisik that he arrives at the right psak. But I guess that Siyata Deshmaya doesn't hold through for arriving there for the right, for the same reason. You know, there can be many, many approaches, and you know, some are more inclined towards a certain mahalach, and others are inclined towards a different mahalach. And again, when there are differences of opinion, so again, that has to be worked out. Again, in the bottom up approach, I usually, you know, we usually whoever I get hold of first, you know, that's going to be the mahalach that we take, because when we have when we're stuck, you know, we have an emergency type of situation. So if we can get hold of Rabbi Belsky and he says this is what we should do, so then, you know, there's no time. You know, that usually just gets implemented at that point. It doesn't make it the OU policy, that makes it the OU psak. Okay. Now I just want, we have, like Rabbi Gross mentioned, we keep track of all the different psakim, and we have in our system literally thousands of shalos and tshuvas. So give, some of them are given names, other ones are just included under weekly write-ups that I do of all the different shalos. But there was an interesting document over here I wanted to share. It's labeled 077. The whole naming and numbering system is a whole chokhmah in and of itself. But this one's called 077, the basis for OU certification. And the Shaila was asked, both to Rebelsky and to Reshachter, how is it that the OU relies on the system of mashkichim going and visiting plants, and they visit maybe, let's say they visit once a month, or maybe they visit twice a month, or maybe they come at I wouldn't call it regular intervals, but they come at intervals. Not there, it's not done with Hashgacha Tmidis. Most plants that the OU certifies are not certified with Hashgacha Tmidis. It's certified based on this type of a system where Hashgiach drops in unannounced. He comes and he'll come any time, but it's usually at some sort of an interval. So monthly visits or something like that. And the question was, what is the basis for that? Where does it say in Shulchan Aruch that you can certify a company based on these monthly unannounced visits? Where does that come from? So, I mean, yeah, I think everyone would agree that that's definitely the minig in Klal Yisrael today, that that's the way Kashrus is done. It's not just the OU. Every Kashrus agency basically works that way. But what is the... Okay, so we're asking, what is the... What is the rationale? Where does this come from? So Rav Shechter says he thinks it's based on the sugya of umin lomarum nasai that creates a ruba delesa kaman. We have a concept umin lomarum nasai. We have a professional. You have an umin, a skilled worker. Let's say a doctor. A doctor gives you a diagnosis. You have a right to believe his diagnosis, even if the doctor is non-Jewish. Not everybody goes to Jewish doctors. You go to non-Jewish doctor as well, and the diagnosis might include things that have to be done on Shabbos and medicines that have to be taken, and right, we follow what the doctors have to say, and that's based on the concept of umen lomarum nasai. If he's a professional doctor, so we have a right to follow his opinion. Part of that is it creates what we call like a ruba delesa kaman. It creates a roiv. Don't know 100% that he's telling you the truth, but we know that in general, an umin doesn't lie. An umin tells you the truth. He's believable. A company is not an individual. It's not we're certifying, Bob and his special recipe, and he's the one behind it. But a company is really the way industrial cashless works today. It's probably about 100 people. We're working in this company, and everybody has various jobs, of course, and there's people who oversee the every aspect. You know, there's someone oversees the incoming ingredients, and someone who does the purchasing, and there's a separate person who does the quality control, and there's another person who's just in charge of the whole the shift operator, and so many people involved, and it's not a matter of one person or two people getting involved in the and deciding to to do some sort of a harama. It really would take, on the part of an organizational level, you have to get everybody involved, everybody on board before. I mean, obviously there are mistakes that can take place, and they do, and that's very important. Then Mashkiach drops by and he checks unannounced. And one of the key jobs of the Mashkiach when he goes into a plant is to check the ingredients, make sure that everything is in order, because things do get through. But to be choshesh that a company is deliberately trying to mislead and to try to create some sort of a ziyuf, so that's very, very rare. I mean, in kashrus world, you know, when that does happen, it's usually becomes a big scandal, but it's very, very rare. And in general, it's the assumption is that umin lo marum nasoi, and that Rav Shachter understood is the basis for why it's acceptable to have these what we call, you know, the monthly visits. Rebelsky, we had one more piece in this. Because of this, though, because we're relying on this idea of umin lo marum nasoi, Rav Shachter insists that there be a lag time before you go and you certify a company. When a company comes to the new company's department and they ask that their product be acceptable, so we should monitor the company for a number of weeks. Usually we'll send them, first we'll have them send us, it goes through a whole process, I guess Rabbi Jenkins will talk about it more, but in a streamlined, easy case, it could take still several months, several weeks for sure, often several months, before a company becomes certified. And during that time, there's time to see that the company operates in a certain professional manner, and they have a, you know, they there's a certain quality assurance that they do, and that's all important before you could certify a company. Really, Reb Shachter says that's the what we're relying on to an extent. Of course, there's the visits, and Rebelsky takes a completely different approach. There's the question. Let me put the original question into other words, in other terms. In Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Kuf Yud Ches, it says that you can have hashkacha done with the yotzei v'nichnas, but the yotzei, if you're going to do it with the yotzei v'nichnas, which is a fine way to do, but it has to be that the mashkiach doesn't stay away a long time. It has to be, he's in and out. That's an acceptable form. If he is gone for a long amount of time, so then it's already only considered b'di'evid. So Rebelsky explains that that's talking about where you have a Jew owns the product and he gives it to, let's say he has a cleaning lady in the house and he wants, or has a chef even in the house, and he's going to watch this chef to make sure that they're not putting in any non-kosher ingredients, and they're going to do it through Yetzir v'Nichnas. You shouldn't tell this chef who's preparing your food that you're going to be gone a long time. You should always drop in, back in every few minutes. Rebelsky explains that there's a different sugya, though. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah on Daf Zayin Aleph that says that if you have a non-Jew who prepares the food himself, it's not a Jewish Jew who's watching over the non-Jew preparing his food, but rather it's the other way around. It's a non-Jewish company, and it's the non-Jew wants to have his food acceptable to be kosher. So that's a whole different situation. There, if the non-Jew is caught with trying to make some sort of a ziyuv, some sort of a chiluf, he's the one who's going to stand to lose. It'll be, you know, everyone will announce that you can't buy from this food anymore. This person will be run out of town. He'll lose his whole business. His whole business is based on his kosher clients, and you know, there are also legal today. We have there are legal reasons why a company is, you know, they'll be in certain. The legal issues as well, and they're forced into, you know, they stand to lose a great deal if they try to make a ziyuf, if they try to make something as kosher that really isn't. So in that halacha in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, the Fayin Aleph, it says that even if you have somebody who comes at unannounced intervals, he comes in, he drops in, and he could come in at any time, that's acceptable. So the normal halachas that we think of yotzei v'nichnas, Rebelsky explains that that's all referring to where it's a yid who owns the food, he gives it to a non-Jew to watch his food for him, so then you need a yotzei v'nichnas, like the type of situation you'd have in your home. But when you have a company where the food belongs to the non-Jew, and he stands to lose, he says then, because of that mirsus, that he could lose his whole business, even if the Jew only appears at very, even if those intervals are very spread out, as long as he could arrive at any time, that's also considered acceptable. So basically, at the OU, we have both of these Mahalchim that we use. The Mashkichim are told to come at sporadic intervals. I mean, they come monthly, but he could come at any time, and he could show up at any time. And on the other hand, we also go through an exhaustive review process ahead of time. And like this, we really are mekayim both of the explanations of both Rav Shechter and Rav Belsky. And that's an example of where, you know, the two opinions, they don't really contradict each other, but rather they enhance each other.
All right. So Gerson gave an example of Shalom bias, in other words. Okay. Thank you, Rav Gerson. As I mentioned before, if you have questions on the first four speakers, we're going to take the questions right after Rabbi Gorelick's presentation. Teddy over there is going to go around collecting the questions. We have one question already, but this question has to do with dairy, and Rabbi Merzel is scheduled for the second half. So the person who asked the question, I'm sure you won't want to leave till the end, but if you want to get an answer, you got to wait till the second question and answer session at the end of the evening. Our next speaker, I was at a Kiddush today in Muncie. They had cake was served. One platter had on it said Yashan, the other one said non-Yashan, and Rabbi Gorelick will explain us what that's all about.
The source for the laws pertaining to Yashan is found in Parsha Semor. These laws are applicable to the Chameshis Haminim, the five grains of barley, oats, rye, spelt, and wheat. These grains are Yashan if they took root prior to Pesach. If the grains did not take root prior to Pesach, then they are Chadash until the subsequent Pesach. There is a halachic dispute if the hashrasha, the taking root, must be 3 days or 2 weeks prior to Pesach. The laws of Chadash do not apply to other grains, such as rice, corn, or buckwheat. A significant number of Meforshim argue that in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, one should be diligent in avoiding Chadash. However, a different Meforshim discussed the general leniency in observing Yashan in Chutz La'aretz. And I'm going to cite some of the approaches that they utilize. Some argue that we have a Sfek Sveka, what we call a double doubt. Maybe the crop is from the previous year, and it's from this year's crop, perhaps it took root prior to Pesach. Others suggest that most grains take root prior to Pesach. And this is especially true in the United States, since 75% of the wheat planted in the United States is winter wheat, which by nature is Yashan. There are those who argue that there are a number of other factors to consider. First of all, is the flour itself Chodesh Yashan? In addition, bread is a staple, and consequently we can view it as Shas Hatchat, that it's so necessary that therefore we could be lenient. Also, flour can be difficult to store. The Aruch HaShulchan cites in Orzarua, who argues that the dispute concerning the prohibition of Chodesh lacks a conclusive resolution, since the Gemara does not offer a definitive psak. This was done on purpose, because if difficult situations arise, then one has the right to rely on the lenient opinion concerning Chodesh outside of Israel. The Aruch HaShulchan also discusses why the prohibition of Chodesh outside of Israel should only be applicable in the lands in close proximity to Israel, as opposed to more distant countries. He compares it to the rabbinic prohibition of Truma Meiser for the lands adjacent to Israel. And lastly, does the prohibition only apply to Jewish-owned land, or does it include non-Jewish ownership? In the United States, most barley and oats are chadash, since they do not take root prior to Pesach. Canadian oats are also chadash, and a significant amount is imported to the United States. However, since Canada is further north than the United States, winter ends later, it takes longer for the fields to thaw, so the Canadian oats come to the American market much later. A good number of Canadian oats have not yet reached, the new Canadian oats hasn't reached the United States yet, or it's just now beginning to arrive in the United States. Domestic rye is always yoshim. However, rye bread can be chadosh, since it is primarily composed of spring wheat. Only some rye is added. Spelt grown in the United States is yoshim. However, Canadian spelt is chadosh, and it is used domestically here in the United States. Winter wheat has both a winter and a spring crop. Winter wheat is yoshon, since it has taken root prior to Pesach. Spring wheat is usually chadosh, since it does not always take root prior to Pesach. And the different wheat yields different types of flour. Low-gluten flour is used for crumbly products, such as cookies, matzah, and pretzels. The source for this flour is winter wheat, which is yoshon. High-gluten flour is used for chewy products, such as bread, challah, pizza, and bagels. It is produced from spring wheat, which is chadosh. Medium gluten flour is a mixture of spring and winter wheat and is also used for bread, challah, and pizza. Durum wheat is needed for pasta products and it is usually a spring crop. The following flours are usually chadosh. I'm sure not too many of you recognize the names, but I'll mention them anyway. High gluten, high strength bread, patent, clear pizza, all-purpose, which I'm sure you've seen in supermarkets, and Graham. Malt is derived from barley, which can be chadosh. The malt is added to wheat flour for baking applications. The amount added is usually less than 1% by volume. The malt enhances the chemical reaction between the flour, yeast, and water. It allows the dough to rise better. Barley malt is added to all barley and grocery flour. Flour made especially for baking cakes and cookies, however, do not contain malt. Barley malt can also be added to some foods for coloring and flavoring. These products include pretzels, candies, cereals, such as cornflakes, beer, vodka, gin, cordials, and prepared cocktails. There is a halachic discussion if the malt added to the above applications can be considered bottled. The chadosh malt usually enters the market around December 15th. White vinegar does not have any chadosh concerns, since barley malt is not an ingredient. The exception is for specialty vinegars, such as malt vinegar, tarragon vinegar, and salad vinegar. Matzah meal is ground matzah, and is therefore yoshon, since matzah is produced from winter wheat. Rye crackers are yoshon, provided that the wheat, oats, and malt listed in the ingredient panel are also yoshon. One must be careful with oatmeal cookies, since both the oats and the wheat flour must be yoshon. Pizza stores sometimes line the oven with semolina flour. One has to be certain that the semolina flour is yoshon. Products from Israel bearing a reliable hechsher are yoshon. Products imported into Israel are not necessarily yoshon. And if a package has multiple hashkoches and also states yoshon, then one must ascertain which kashrus agency assumes responsibility for the yoshon status of the product. As far back as the 1930s, domestic wheat was stored and was therefore yoshon. During the 1950s, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik became the Rav HaMachshir of Strides Products. Before accepting the hashkocha, Rav Aaron investigated the milling process and also inquired about the flour sources. The latter inquiry was important for Rav Aaron, since he observed the laws of yoshon. He found that the domestic wheat was not being stored, and consequently one could no longer assume that the flour in the marketplace was yoshon. Rav Aaron informed Strites that he would provide hashkocha only if all their products would be yoshon, and the company agreed to this provision. Based on the aforementioned information, Rav Aaron ate matzah and not bread until he purchased the freezer to store the various products. When Rav Aaron moved to Chicago, he convinced a bakery to become yoshon, and eventually other bakeries in Chicago did the same. Rav Yitzchak Giffen, a Talmud of Rav Aaron, guided these bakeries in observing yoshon. In the 1970s, other individuals became concerned when the United States began selling its surplus wheat to the Russians. Consequently, the domestic storage was depleted, and one could no longer assume that the flour was Yashan. Due to this situation, Rabbi Yosef Herman of Muncie, New York, began compiling information about the Yashan status of the domestic grains. Because of his diligence, more people have access to Yashan information, and it is easier to observe this mitzvah. When Rabbi Herman first began gathering information, he utilized the halachic principle of Meisich Futumo, which entails the following. One can ask a non-Jew questions, and if we are sure that he doesn't know where we're coming from, then we can rely on the information. However, if he knows where we're coming from, then we cannot rely on the information. So at the outset, he relied on Meisich Futumo. The companies would inform him about packing dates, best use dates, and purchase dates. This information helped determine the Chodosh or Yoshin status of a product. Recently, Rabbi Herman decided that the Meisich Futumo would no longer be applicable, since the companies are now aware about the significance of the Yoshin market in certain areas where the large concentration of Jewish people, or religious Jewish people. Therefore, Rabbi Herman determines the Chodosh information based on the USDA crop progress reports. He calculates the earliest possible conceivable date that the product could be viewed as Chodosh. Consequently, he has earlier cutoff dates than in the past. I discussed this matter with Rabbi Belsky and Rabbi Schechter, and they disagree with Rabbi Herman. They feel that if one asks different companies the same question, and they happen to give basically the same answer, we don't have to assume they're in cahoots together to try to deceive those who are concerned about Yashan. So therefore, we can ask companies, and a lot of them do not know where we're coming from, and they do provide important information to us. In order to observe Yashan, one must store the various products. If flour is not stored in a refrigerator, then infestation can occur. The eggs of the flour beetle enter the mill attached to the wheat. Flour mill companies have a cleaning system to remove virtually all the eggs. The remaining eggs are able to hatch live beetles that have a life cycle of 21 days. The probability of the eggs hatching is increased as the storage time and the storage temperature increases. In addition, worms can enter the flour bags even if the opening is extremely minute. Therefore, it is imperative to store the flour in refrigerated conditions, be certain that the flour bags have no openings, and maintain proper cleanliness. For a number of years, General Mills has worked closely with the OU to provide Yoshin flour, but this was done for 50 and 100 pound bags. You don't find that in the supermarket. The Mashkiach at General Mills in the past supervised the milling of the Yoshin flour, and the bags are marked with the word Yoshin. Once the Chodosh wheat enters the mill, the OU supervised Yoshin production concludes, and we don't certify anymore. And then General Mills would place these bags in cold storage in order to prevent infestation. However, 2 years ago, General Mills decided that they don't want to deal with cold storage, and they don't want to get involved in all the gory details of what has to be done. So therefore, the Mashkiach tells me when is the last date that the Yoshin flour was at the plant, when is the date when the new flour or new wheat came into the plant, so we know the cutoff date, and it's marked on the bag. For those of you who are Mashkichim here, who visit restaurants and caterers, it's August 9th, 2009, for General Mills. There have been companies that want to sell fresh Yashan. Sounds funny, fresh Yashan. Because if you wait, you have the problems which I enumerated. So how can you have fresh Yashan if the plant already has Chodosh in the facility? So both Rabbi Belsky and Rabbi Schechter were involved in devising a method, and the Pesach that was established is the following. When prior to the Chodosh wheat first ever appearing in the company, we seal the Yoshan wheat in bins, and it's under lock and key of the Mashkiach. During the fall and winter, when the company wants to do a Yoshan run, then the company has to inform us, inform Mashkiach, and a very prominent mashgiach of the OU who is here, who helps me with Yoshim production, Rabbi Zorach Spira. He wanted to come this evening all dressed in white flour, but he decided not to. Last week would have been better because last Motzei Shabbos in Clifton, we did have a Yoshim run. So they would contact the mashgiach and myself. He would go to the plant to release the flour. But what about the chadash that was in the line till then? Well, you would say, let them wash it out. Companies do not like to wet wash flour mill lines. So what do? So the decision of both Rabbis Belsky and Schechter is that what is the cleaning system to get rid of the chadash? Is we clean it with yashan. There's a flush of the yashan flour throughout the system, and that yashan flour that goes through that first pallet is designated as chadash, but that is used to clean the system. Then the subsequent system, subsequent production, are all viewed as yashan. And one other point, according to OU policy, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik also follow this approach, that we need Eino Ben Yomo in order to kasher from Chodesh to Yosha. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take questions. We have quite a few. There's one question here that somebody asked about insect infestation with strawberries that we're going to have next week. Rabbi Eisen, who's a well-known expert on the Tzedikas Tehillim, will be coming to Tiferes. That's next week's presentation. We'll keep that question for next week. Okay, the rabbis have mics next to them, and we'll try to go through various questions that were raised here. Rabbi Koretsky, bread mixes such as Pillsbury OUD are not considered bread. Are they then considered cake, like cornbread, apple, cinnamon, pumpkin, and therefore do not fall into the bread category?
Shilos Kokum Kotzi Chubali, you answered your question. As we said, any bread mix we would not therefore, certainly as though we would not certify OUD. The ones you mentioned are not bread. It's important. The word bread is not the eat here. What is it? Carrot bread is the word bread. That's irrelevant. Carrot bread is a cake, a cornbread, etc. A bread is a bread of a chamaceous mina.
Sure. Rabbi Gorelick, is Yashin assumed for major companies? Why, if so, is it not on the label?
I'm not sure I understand the question. We would put it on the label if it is in fact Yashin. Right? We would put on the label OU if it's kosher, OUD if it's kosher dairy. So if the person would clarify the question, we might be able to answer it better. We don't certify those companies as Yashan. Then it would be on the label. If it's an OU, you probably would put it on the label, or if it's not on the label, we can always ask. And if we happen to have information about an invisible product, as you mentioned, that happens to Yashan, we'd be glad to tell you. But don't assume it's Yashan until it says on the label, or you ask the rabbinic ordinator in your office if he knows anything about it.
Rabbi Koretsky, when you take challah off from an industrial plant, how do you do it? I.e., do you walk up to the big mixer and stick your hand in and pull it out?
You still have a hand.
As I mentioned before, usually an industrial setting, even in a retail setting, you can't always have it done in the traditional, an actual hafrasha. It's a very complicated system of the halacha, which would require a long shear, and privately we can discuss it. There are a lot of halachas, if it goes back to a Shulchan Aruch, back to a Tzur, back to a Smag, back to a Rebbe Elazar Yemin. It's the whole system we have with Tevel, in the plant with the rabbi, the mashiach, basically with the mafresh men akemach, and it's been chal on subsequent leashes. That's just in a general way. But it's a very complicated thing with nusach hafrasha worked out. That's exactly what I said, that we usually can't do it with actually somebody being taken actually from each particular ESO.
Rabbi Gorelick, like if Chodesh wheat was baked before Pesach, does it become mutter to eat after Pesach?
Yes, Pesach allows any Chodesh to become Yashon. Once Pesach has come, then any product that would have been Chodesh prior to Pesach now becomes Yashon after Pesach.
Okay, Rabbi Gersten, oleochemicals are used extensively in industrial cleaners. If the formulated product is poisonous, is there a problem with kashrus, or can we rely on nice and tamlif gum?
Right, the item is
kashrus,
and soaps, the bleach, things like this do not need a kashrus symbol. However, many companies do want to have a hashkafa on them. And when they do, we insist that all the ingredients in fact be kosher. So while it's not necessary, people want to be mahadir, they want to make sure they can use soaps on their dishes and things like that, they want to have this only kosher ingredients, then we, if it has an OU on it, then we are certifying that there's no non-kosher in that poisonous item.
Now a few more questions. Why doesn't the OU provide guidance to the proper bracha for food items? Rabbi Gersten,
In a way, it would be inappropriate for us to do so. Every person should ask the local rav what bracha to make. There was a whole question once that people wanted on their pizza. It should say berachaso mezonos, which led to. Which is very misleading to begin with, because while true pizza might be mizonos, if your kaveh suda becomes a motzi, which you understand, makes it very complicated to put brachas on foods. It depends on the way you eat them, and it depends on also which rabbi you ask. So we'd rather not get involved in that. If you call the OU, though, they will tell you what the OU would say, what bracha to make.
If I can just follow up my question, I had a case where I called about a year or so ago about honeycomb, because on the box of honeycomb it says this is a corn and oat cereal.
Honeycomb is an okay product, not
OU. I understand.
That's it. That's it.
As a concept, you have a product that has got corn and oats in it, and happened to be that.
Call the okay. Next. What is the OU policy? We're going to take two more questions now. There's a few more here, but we're going to move along and take them at the end. Two more questions here. What is the OU policy with respect to food that appears non-kosher? Hamburgers with soy cheese, pizza with soy meat. Rabbi Gersten.
Okay. Let's take the soy question, soy milk, things like that. If a person, decides to then use it to eat it after, add it to their coffee, have it after meat, things like that. Even at restaurants, we allow soy products, and the reason being because it's already generally accepted. People know about soy products, they know about non-dairy creamers. Even things as far as hamburgers with soy cheese on them, I believe the OU has some restaurants that make that. Rodolsky and the Schachter have set forth certain guidelines of how it should be done. It has to say on the menu, has to list it as part of cheese. It shouldn't say on it cheeseburger. It should say burger with part of cheese on it. It has to be listed in certain ways. And the idea being that people are today, I think, are familiar with these concepts, and therefore they don't consider it to be a marasayan anymore.
A final question, Rabbi Gersten. Are the OU tshuvas available to the public?
They're not available in the sense of anyone just going online and getting them, but they are available. If people want them, they can either call me at the OU and ask me for them, or they can send me an email. If anybody wants, they can take down my email address. Mm-hmm. It's Gersten E. It's the way it's spelled on the card, Gersten E at OU.org. And I get people emailing me all the time, individuals, organizations, like I mentioned before, they want to know what does the OU say about what's the policy. I'm very happy to share that information.
Our next speaker is Rabbi Gutterman, who will speak about refined oils. He'll be referring to this colored sheet. Rabbi Gutterman.
I don't know if anyone's here heard of the company ADM, Archer Daniel Midland, but it's a pretty safe bet that sometime today, or certainly this week, you've eaten an ADM product. They make products that come from corn and soy, and every imaginable thing you can do with corn and soy that can be used as food, they've figured out, and they sell the high fructose corn syrup in your Coke, it's probably ADM or Pepsi. Corn oil, but the main the ADM is an oil company, and that's what I'm here to talk to you about. I'm the RC at the OU for ADM, and that's how I got involved with oils. And I'm just going to talk a little bit tonight about the different types of oils, the oil production, and the kosher issues involved with certifying oil as kosher. I have these picture handouts if you have, just because a lot of people don't know what they're talking about or don't have any idea when they read an ingredient panel, if they ever would, what the different types of oil are and what does that mean, palm oil anyway. So I hope this discussion tonight, besides making you more aware of how the OU runs the kashrus of oils, it'll make you more of an educated consumer in general, because there's a lot of items that come from the production of oil that are in the foods you eat that you will now recognize at least the names of. Okay, so the first type of oil, which is not on this picture, because you all know it, is olive oil. Everybody knows what an olive looks like. You don't need me to show you a picture of an olive. Olive oil is when it's extra virgin olive oil that is just an olive oil crushed, pressed, and they got the oil from it. That's a cold process. There's not really much kosher issue to worry about. It's not an oil that gets transported heated. So I believe the policy still stands that extra virgin oil doesn't really need a hechsher. Anything after extra virgin olive oil does need a hechsher, because that needs to be refined. There's chemical processes involved. So that's where you would need a hechsher. Of course, with I personally think, anyway, if you ever have a choice of something with a hechsher or without a hechsher, even if it doesn't officially need a hechsher, if it's the same price and it's no big deal, it's always better to go with the hechsher, because even in anything could be treif. That doesn't mean you have to be worried that it's treif if everybody knows you can buy water without a hechsher. But you know, everything could be treif. It might be on shared equipment or something else. So even though you don't have to buy it with a hechsher, if you have a choice, it's always better to have a hechsher. Then you know for sure you're safe. The oil we're most familiar with, I think that it's supposed to be one of the healthiest oils that most people use in their homes, canola oil. I don't know how many people know what canola oil is. That first picture you see of rape seeds. Canola oil is rapeseed oil. Someone developed this rapeseed, and oil that comes from it is supposed to be one of the healthiest oils. And I guess someone in marketing thought rapeseed wouldn't sell that well. So they decided, since it was made in Canada, so Canada oils, canola is Canada oil, low acid, but that's the idea. Canola is Canada oil, but it's rapeseed oil. The next one is palm oil. If you look in ingredient panels, you'll see a lot of things you eat have palm oil in it or palm kernel oil. So for a long time, when I had to deal with oils, I was doing with this idea. Concept palm oil, I had no idea what it was. So you have a picture. This is what it is. There's a palm tree. There's actually fruit that grow on a palm tree. You can see the picture. You have a big picture of palm fruit there. That's what it is. If you turn to the next page, you'll see the inside of a palm fruit. That white in the middle is called the kernel, palm kernel. The outside is the palm. So those are the two different types of oil. There's palm oil, palm kernel oil. Two totally different oils, and they both come from the palm fruit. And lastly is soybean oil. So soybeans over there, and that gets me back to ADM. That is ADM's major oil, is soybean oil, and that's what I'd like to focus on, is soybean oil. Now just a quick history. Historically, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm mistaken. If you're trying to think, what oil did your Bubby use in Europe when she made her cake? What was there, oil? there wasn't palm oil, there wasn't coconut oil, probably wasn't olive oil. So that they had chicken fat, they had butter. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know of what oil they could have had in Poland in some shtetl. I'm not sure. You know, if you look in the Mishnah we read in Bava Madlikin Friday night, right? There's oils listed there. There's shemen shumshin, it goes in tzinonos. There's sesame oil, nut oil, radish oil. Sounds very tasty. There were oils that they had, but I don't know how much of that was actually used normally. They probably had to use mostly fats. As I think Rabbi Friel mentioned, the difference between an oil and a fat is a solid at room temperature, and oil is a liquid at room temperature, but other than that, they're the same. So it's a relatively new thing that we had kosher vegetable oils, period, available to Yidden. And historically also, plants that made vegetable oil used to generally make animal oil fats. And that was a big... It's very hard to deal with when you have plants that make animal oil, they make maybe fish oil that comes from tray fish, vegetable oil, they'll refine butter there, you have dairy, pyrus, tray. Facilities like that are a nightmare to deal with, and they certainly should require hashgacha tmidis, and even then, you know, good luck. They're very difficult. Oil facilities are humongous, acres and acres of pipes going this way and that way, and to try to figure out what went where and back and forward. But I'm going to describe a little bit to you why there's such an issue with a lot of facilities, but you'll get the idea from this story. When I first came to the OU, not the first day, but at some point they informed me I would be the RC of ADM, and I at the time didn't know much about oil, so I said, okay, well, hold on, let me go visit an oil facility. And the closest one to Passaic that I found that was OU was Purdue. Yes, Purdue Chickens. Purdue Chicken, Purdue, the company Purdue is an OU company for its oil. Now if you want to, why that is, that they, besides making chickens, they make soybean oil. That's part of this whole idea of how oil works. So I went down there and the man explained to me, he said, I saw these silos, humongous silos of soybeans. Huge. They look like football fields of just soybeans, plain soybeans. So what do they need that for? The feed for the chickens. Purdue wants to make their own food for their own chickens, and the proteins in soybeans is what they want. So they separate the protein, they separate the oil from the protein, so now they have pure protein to feed to their chickens, and now they got some leftover soybean oil. What are you going to do with that? Someone said, maybe we should make a business out of this. So they went in, now it's Purdue Oil. And before I continue, I want to just bring out something. When I saw the list of divisions, ADM has a lot of divisions, and when I saw the list of divisions, I thought that this was a company that was going to be bankrupt the next day, because it looked like they were in way too many businesses. There was ADM Oils. There was ADM Lecithin. Okay, that's another company. They have ADM Milling, flour. They have a protein division. They have a pharmaceutical division where they make vitamin E pills. They make pills to help with cholesterol. They call it CardioAid. And I didn't really know, they're crazy. You got to stick to your core business. You know, if you make oils, fine. But the pharmaceuticals, less than this. I didn't really know what they had to do with each other. And part of my visit when I went to Purdue, and he really just, I told him I was really there to learn, you know. And he explained to me the whole soybean process. It became very clear where all those came from. So to make soybean oil, so first you have to extract the oil, usually done with hexane, and that you now have, hexane is not a kosher sensitive item, and crude oil, crude vegetable oil is generally also acceptable without hashgacha, but you don't eat crude oil, so it won't be nogeh anyone in this room. You have a picture here of crude soybean oil. As you can see, it looks pretty gross. You would not want to eat that. Okay. So as the man from Purdue explained to me, what they take the crude... You have on the next page, by the way, the different words I'm going to use of processing of soybeans or different oils. I'm not going to go through it. Don't get scared. So you have it here, the words. The first part is degumming for soybean. So soybeans have these... any crude oil, as you see, has a lot of gunk. You need to remove the gunk to get it to the next picture of refined soybean oil. As you can see, it looks a lot different. So the first part is degumming. They use a put in water and sometimes citric acid, and then they use a centrifuge to remove the gums from the oil, and now you have degummed oil. That gum that should be garbage for the soybean, for soybean oil, that gum is lecithin, crude lecithin. Lecithin, you'll notice in a lot of your ingredient pads, you'll see soy lecithin. It's an emulsifier, like Rabbi Frill explained, that keeps two things together. Keep cocoa butter and cocoa powder together from not separating in your chocolate bar. Soy lecithin is in a lot. So that garbage, someone also said, same like Purdue went into the oil business, start with, let's make a business. Everything becomes a business. So now they got all this leftover gums, and they became ADM lecithin. After that, you have neutralization, or the refining process, and that is where they want to remove free fatty acids. What those are, it's not really important. They want to remove the free fatty acids. They'll add caustic soda to it, and the caustic soda removes the soaps. Well, it removes the free fatty acids. They become soaps. The soap gets sold to Dial, for real. That's another business. And so then that's this is in short, neutralization or refining. Then you have bleaching, where they're trying to get rid of that nasty-looking color that you see. So they cook it up with bleaching something. I forget what it's called. They cook it up with some ingredient, which also, nothing here, what I've said so far is kosher-sensitive in and of itself. They cook it up, and that gets rid of the carotenes, makes it less color. And deodorization is where they send it to the deodorization column. They sparge it with steam to get rid of the parts that make it not smell as nice. When they put it through a deodorizer and that steam goes up and takes away all the parts that make it not smell so nice, that garbage, they catch that garbage called steam distillate. So that distillate they catch is full of tocopherols, which is vitamin E. So from that they make vitamin E, hence the vitamin E business. When they refine that, they also have a thing that has been proven to lower cholesterol. That's cardioid. So that's their pharmaceutical division. So the whole point is it's all about making as much profit as you can, not throwing away anything. It's all about efficiency. Okay. So part of the problem with efficiency is that it can cause kosher problems, because if you have a facility that just does this, it's really not a whole lot to worry about. It's just doing vegetable oil. If they're doing other things, let's say they also refine animal fats rather. So even if they have separate, you know, a whole separate, different separate tanks, separate this, everything separate, but the companies like to reuse stuff. The water they use to heat the tanks that have the animal fats in them, they'll use that water now to do the neutralization process, or to when they run the water through the with the gumming, or in the neutralization process where they actually stick water in there. That water might have been water used to heat the animal tanks, animal fat tanks. There are the steam used in the deodorizer. If the deodorizer was used for non-kosher, so obviously you have a problem there. And it's very difficult to kosher a deodorizer. They're hard to clean, and they are not meant to be clean. They're meant to be greased up. The machine doesn't really work that well when it's not full of grease. But even if you had separate systems, sometimes the steam used to heat these things is recirculated. You'll have steam that heats the kettle, and then that steam goes back, the condensate goes back to the boiler, gets used for kosher product. So this whole idea of efficiency makes it that if you have a facility that does kosher and treif and dairy, you could have your innocent soybean oil become either dairy or treif, because the water used with it might have been non-kosher. So whenever we have a dairy or a non-kosher kosher soybean place, it's usually done with hashgacha tmidus, and as I said, ulei haiv ulei, it's a very difficult thing to do. There's another process called hydrogenation, which is, this is also will help you as a consumer. When you read labels, you'll see there are saturated fats listed, unsaturated fats, and trans fat. So when you have a fat that is if it's more liquid and you want to make it harder, or sometimes to extend its shelf life, if you add a hydrogen, if there's room to add, if it's an unsaturated fat, that means it's not saturated with hydrogen. If you add hydrogen to it, then it becomes a hydrogenated fat, and if it's full of hydrogens, it becomes a saturated fat. So hydrogenation is done with a reaction with a nickel catalyst. From a kosher perspective, that catalyst has to be kosher. There are times where you can have a nickel catalyst going from facility to facility or different parts of the same facility. You have to watch the nickel catalyst as well. But they can make the oil when you hydrogenate oil. So you're adding a hydrogen to it. It makes it usually more solid, and it extends its shelf life, and it also adds trans fat. Trans fat do not occur in nature; that they're done by hydrogenation. And that's, if you ask the local doctors today, that you might as well take cyanide. It's supposed to be very unhealthy. So because of that, there is a process called interesterification, and sometimes enzymatic interesterification. Okay. Well, all right. I'll say this real fast. One more minute. basically, you can sometimes have... you have an oil that doesn't exactly perform the way you'd like it to perform, and you can sometimes take another oil or some other substance and mix the two together somehow to make a better oil. Just very quickly, cocoa butter is incredibly expensive. Cocoa butter is a fat. Usually vegetable oils are called oils. Things from animals are called fats because they're usually solid at room temperature. Whenever a vegetable oil is actually solid at room temperature, they don't want to insult it by calling it a fat. It's a butter. Okay, so cocoa butter is a very expensive thing, and when you if you want to make it cheaply, so cocoa butter is exciting because it melts at body temperature. It melts in your mouth, it's solid and on the table, and you put it in your mouth, it melts. So that's what you want to mimic. So you can take sunflower oil and some other thing called stearin, and you take an enzyme, react it together, we're skipping the whole story how that works, and it can mimic now the properties that they mix together. They share their different, they shift chemical how they're put together, and now the sunflower oil mimics cocoa butter. You'll find that in a lot of things. You see enzymatically interesterified oils. That's what it means. The kosher issue there is the same as anything else. There is direct steam injection. That means they shoot steam right in there into your food. If that steam came from treif, it's not kosher, so that's the issue there, and I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Gutterman, for explaining a complicated topic in a very short time. Our next speaker, the first question of the evening, which I didn't say it publicly, I don't know if the next speaker can answer this question, was given on an index card, where are the Tootsie Roll samples? Rabbi David Jenkins.
Well, we've gotten in my house more questions about Tootsie Rolls than my wife's chomp. And I didn't realize another piece of candy would be such a thing, even though I remember the last time I had Tootsie Rolls, 5 years old, and I lost my baby tooth. So at the OU, we made a deal with a few dentists that after you have Tootsie Rolls, we'll give you some cards, and you'll get fillings replaced, and we'll get a kickback. We'll get about 5%, so we'll work on it later. So Tootsie Roll, in general, or you can really ask the question, how does the OU, in general, go after business? Like, what's the right thing to do? So we do have a secret weapon in our office called Phyllis Kogel, who gets doors open all the time for us to get in and try to get some business. But what's very interesting is, as we're speaking, I went with Phyllis to Chicago, and we went to the candy show, which is in Chicago, because more candy is manufactured in Chicago than just about anywhere else in the world, excluding Belgium with their chocolates. And what's interesting is we're dealing with this fellow by the name of Barry Bowen, who's also a Cub fan, even though he lives in Milwaukee. So as we're talking, us Midwest Perth people together, there's one thing he asked. He asked the question. He says, I see that the kosher business out there is like a $17 billion business. So he said to me, David, is that really true? And I said, really, it's a bunch of hooey. Because what happens is there's some people who've gotten together that crafts, since it's kosher, so it means all craft sales are now kosher sales, which is not true. The bottom line I did tell him that in the Northeast is that if you become kosher, your sales will go up anywhere between 2 to 4%. So right here we're talking about the tri-state area where there's over 30 million people, 2 to 4% in sales is millions of dollars. And that's a true number. There is, in the Northeast is where when companies want to become kosher, this is the place where they want to sell, because this is where their market go up tremendously. Right now the OU is working on another company called Gatorade, reason why they want to become kosher is because they know the Northeast sales, and it happens to be that Powerade sales went up, especially in the Northeast, and Gatorade sales here in the Northeast went down because they're not kosher. So what's interesting is another question that Tootsie Roll asked us as we're meeting with them in their offices on 75th and Cicero in Chicago, right past Midway Airport. They asked us a question, is what's the difference why we should go to the OU over any other certification? So originally I was in the OU in the 80s, and I was out of the OU for a number of years and came back. So per Phyllis, I thought she was going to have a heart attack when I answered it, and I told the answer to Barry Bowen is there's really no difference whatsoever. And so I thought Phyllis was going to need some nitroglycerin pills, because how can you say that if we're trying to get business for the OU? And the answer is that the worst thing we want to ever do is ever, ever show the people in business that organizations are competing against each other, because it's basically a chil Hashem. And we don't want to do that, because all the other kashrus organizations work hard and are also doing a good job. And the last thing we have to do is barab and go ahead and say, well, you know, we're good because, you know, we serve chont in the office and they don't. We don't want to say that because it's not a nice thing to do. So what I did tell them, which is true, there's two reasons the OU, why you should come to the OU. One, we have 66% of the market, which is true. 66% of the kosher food market is with an OU. And we have a tremendous infrastructure. The tremendous infrastructure is why is a mile to go to the OU. So let me give you an example, and we'll get back to Tootsie Roll in a minute. So we have this wonderful person here by the name of Rabbi Gerstein. So I came up with an idea. My favorite beer is Guinness. So I said, you know what? Let's go after Guinness. But there's a problem with Guinness. And what's in Guinness and what do they use as a clarification? They use isinglass, which I think was originally developed in, I think, the late 1600s. And I think it was really, from what I remember, is originally came up, the pirates in the Caribbean came up with this concept with rum. And what it comes from different fish pieces and guts. It's really good. It's not herring. To shy if the fish is kosher or not. So he asked Rabbi Gerstein, should we go after Guinness? So he said, let me ask Rabbi Yisrael Belsky. And Rabbi Yisrael Belsky said, no. Because the isinglass really could be considered like a Dover HaMaimed, if I'm correct. And the answer was no. So before we go after business, what we do is the first thing you do is you go to Rabbi Yisrael Belsky, you go to Rabbi Gerstein here, and you find out if it's even possible to do, which is a tremendous milo. Now, as we were going and getting involved with Tootsie Roll, really, the reason why they wanted to become kosher is one reason, is because they want to make more money. And they know that we like to eat, and the company, which was originally started in 1896, by Leo Hirschfeld, who was a Yid from Austria, came up with a new concept in New York, is why have chocolate that melts in your hand? He didn't think of M&M's yet. That Mars came up with later. So come up with some sort of chocolate that will be able to take the temperature and people can enjoy it. So he came up with that concept in 1896. And by 1905, he ended up moving from his little store, which I think was in the Bronx, to a nice five-story factory in Manhattan that in 1917 became, at that point, on the stock exchange. And you can look online yourself to see this, and they had a whole thing of, you know, Tootsie Roll became a very famous candy very quickly. And in the 40s, as part of the rations that every American soldier had, which is funny, I was talking to my Uncle Leonard, this is not a good story, but he was on third wave of D-Day, and only him and two people made it to the shore, everybody else got killed. And he was so nervous that he took his Tootsie Roll out and put it in his mouth and ate the paper with it. And I told him about Tootsie Roll, but that's how scared he was being in Omaha Beach. But it's something that was a very famous thing, Tootsie Roll, for many, many years. And over the years, there's been many kosher organizations doing after Tootsie Roll. And when I was in Chicago running the CRC, I went after Tootsie Roll. And it came up that the reason they wanted to go kosher was they were afraid of what? that what happens if one of their biggest ingredients is whey, and if they can't get kosher whey, they're out of business. So it's interesting, we have another secret weapon in the OU. His name is Rabbi Jurvel. Rabbi Jurvel is, for all practical purposes, I would say, is a Talmud Muvik of Rabbi Goldzweig. I don't know if anybody ever heard of Rabbi Chaim Goldzweig. Well, it used to be in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, in the early 80s, there was two people who ran kashrus. His name is Rabbi Nutta Greenblatt on one side of the Mason-Dixie line, and there's Rabbi Goldzweig on the other side of the Mason-Dixie line. And these people who are Gedolim, and are, when it comes to Psak and Shas and everything, they're Mamish Gedolim. That's how kashrus went. And Rabbi Jurvel, who is our secret weapon, is also cut from the same cloth. And what happens like this: Tootsie Roll, once we got in the door, thanks to Phyllis Kogel, and we built up a relationship, there's a lot of steps that go before a company can become kosher. So you have to have an application, and you have to send a check. Check's also good, right? Right? We like checks, right? But what happens is they have to send us their ingredients. In order to, for them, once they send their ingredients, it goes into our ingredient approval division. We have a whole division of people who run ingredients. We have a department that runs ingredients that are for new companies, and then once they become an old company, there's a separate division that deals with the upkeep of all those ingredients. Our ingredient database, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of ingredients are in there, but it's a full-time job just to be on top of this. So what we decided to do, because Tootsie Roll really didn't have a clue whatsoever what they were getting involved with, so what did we do, which is we don't always do, is we sent Rabbi Jurvel to Chicago to deal with the company, do what's called the initial inspection, and to go through the whole facility. Already in his hand, he already had the ingredients already put in our system, so we went with a list of ingredients and the products they were looking to do. So Rabbi Jurvel spent the day there, and I got a call from Barry Bowen, who had a tremendous time with Rabbi Jurvel, who said that Rabbi Jurvel, after being there, knew the plan better than anybody there, and gave him some ideas in production on how they can maybe simplify and become more efficient. And this is a true story. Okay, so what happened was, by Rabbi Jurvel going there, which we basically did is we cut around some of our own red tape, he was able to tell us at that point exactly what the situation was. Tootsie Roll, happens to be all the ingredients they were using were 100% kosher, and they really did not even kosherization. So if you really want to go ahead and eat Tootsie Roll right now, you really could. But if you lose your fillings, the OU does not take any responsibility for your fillings or your caps. So it comes out like this. And don't forget, it's dairy. Thank you. It's dairy. It is not part of it. It's dairy. Now, what was it? Huh? Cholestan. Right. There's not enough way to make that fillings roll. Anyway, what's very interesting is that what's happening is that's not the only thing that Tootsie Roll does. They do a lot of things. They do charms and Tootsie Pops. I don't know how many licks you get to the center. And sugar daddies. There's a whole group of things. Tootsie Roll is one of the largest manufacturing companies for candy. The only one bigger is Mars. Mars is tremendous, and Mars is privately owned, even though there's still the family, the Rubens are still involved with it, but they're not the sole owners, even though they have majority shares, you might say. But what's interesting about this, which is for the OU is very exciting that Tootsie Roll came to us, is just to go through the process a little bit, and what we did was, again, Phyllis was able to open up the door, I was able to build up a relationship, but we decided to do something which at that time we thought was pretty neat, is we sent them a PowerPoint presentation with a voiceover, this Rabbi Gorella did, okay, and we sent it to them, and they were very impressed with the professionalism of the PowerPoint, and especially of Rabbi Gorella's voice. Everybody knows he lays everywhere here, so you know he's a very good voice. So it went over beautifully, and they were very excited about the fact that we were responsive right away. The fact is that Rabbi Jurvel was there very quickly and was able to ascertain exactly what happened. They really liked Reb David's voice too, they told me. So they might even start using him, hearing him Tootsie Roll commercials, and you know that he really did it. Now what's also interesting about what we do is right now the PR has not come out because we have another secret weapon, you know, called Rabbi Safran. And a lot of our PR does come out from Rabbi Safran, who's an unbelievable person, who's very methodical and never lets a rock not be unturned, and very aggressive at getting things done in a good way. So right now he's working together with Tootsie Roll in the PR, which is interesting, as Rabbi Safran has been able over the years, as new companies have come on, help them get into places they can't get themselves, like the New York Times and places like that, where Rabbi Safran, through our connections that we have in the OU, has been able to pull that off, which is tremendous. We also help companies, for an example, which are helping Tootsie Roll, is there's some ingredients they needed. They needed ingredients because there's some things that needed not to be changed in this product, but in other products that are going to be coming soon. And what we're able to do is come up with alternative suppliers for their ingredients, which is very, very important. Another thing is, now that we're there and we have our mashgiach going through the place, our kosher supervisor, there's certain things that they weren't aware they need to keep records of. Not that they were even input, like, for example, corn syrup, their shipments of corn syrup, they didn't even have a clue how to do that. So we were able to help them organize their office and how they should keep all the paperwork that comes in. So, again, like I'm saying, is all kosher organizations out there, reliable ones, are all very good, and they all work very, very hard. But what we're very thankful, dear you, to have is, you see this beautiful staff that we have here that makes it happen that we can be proficient and be able to give the company what they need and to help them in their kosher program. Thank you.
Start with David, even though you didn't answer the question about the samples, but we'll overlook
if
that.
If they want, they have to shot in my house later.
That's right. So we're talking about free samples. Okay. Our next speaker is Rabbi Merzel. He's going to discuss dairy issues.
Just about as soon as I got to the OU, I was assigned to work with dairy companies. Not sure why. I'm lactose intolerant, don't really like it, but the truth is that since then I've worked with a whole lot of other industries as well, and I really find dairy to be pretty much the most interesting one from a halachic and a practical aspect. I want to kind of share a little bit of that with you. At the OU, we are proud of being able to serve all of Klal Yisrael, as much of Klal Yisrael as possible. That's true in the Kashrus division and in the community services divisions. And I think the dairy industry kind of brings it out perhaps better than any other, and I'll explain what I mean. You know, we all know that the Shulchan Aruch tells us that there's something called Chalav Akum, which is forbidden, it's Aser. And not only that, if you cook it in your pot, it'll make your pot treif as well. And what's Chalav Akum? It's any milk that was milked by a Gentile, not in the presence of a Jew. So you use it, your pot becomes treif, and you have to kosher it. And people know as well that Rav Moshe has a famous tshuva, Cholav HaKompanis. It's one of the joys of learning, one of the side benefits of learning Igros Moshe. You get to figure out how he's going to spell companies. Kuf Aleph Mem Pei Aleph Nun Yud Ayin Sam. Cholav HaKompanis is mutter. And he says because nowadays we're operating in the U.S., and there are government agencies overseeing the farm and government agencies overseeing the factory that processes and bottles the milk. And the farm and the processor are afraid of fines. And if they were to adulterate the milk, they'd get in trouble. And so we can realistically assume, says Rav Moshe, that the milk coming out of there is unadulterated. And that would not fall under the getter of Cholav Akum as defined by the Shulchan Aruch. That's Rav Moshe's tshuva. And I think we could say that in Klal Yisrael there are three general practices with regard to Rav Moshe's tshuva. There are those that take advantage of it and are going to go as soon as they can from here, go buy a Tootsie Roll. And then there are those in the middle who are machmir, like Rav Moshe says, bal nefesh to be machmir. So there are those who consider themselves to be bali nefesh and they're machmir, which would mean they don't eat chalav hakompanis. But on the other hand, if they were to accidentally make their hot chocolate in their pot and cook Cholav HaKompanis in their pot, they wouldn't necessarily kosher it either. And then there's the third group, which consider it to actually be treif. And if they were to mistakenly use Cholav HaKompanis in their pot, they would kosher it afterwards. So how do we at the OU try to satisfy all these people? That's a lot of people. So as everyone knows, we do certify items that are chalav stam, chalav hakompanis. You can go to Target and buy market pantry brand milk with an OUD on it. It's not chalav Yisrael, and you know that because it doesn't say chalav Yisrael on it next to the OU symbol. And we do that because we want those who do rely on Rav Moshe's Heter to know that they can eat products that are chalav hakompanis with a full confidence that it is kosher and meets the highest standards under the heter of Rav Moshe. We do, of course, certify items that are Chol of Yisrael, and it'll say OU and Chol of Yisrael, sometimes in Hebrew, sometimes in English. But how do we satisfy that last group, those who would consider it to be not kosher so much so that they would have to kosher their kelim afterwards? Well, the interesting thing about dairy is that the same exact equipment that bottles and processes milk is perfect for bottling and processing orange juice. And the same equipment that's really good for processing dairy cookies is also just as good for processing parv cookies, which means that if you want to make an OU parv product after a dairy one, you're going to have to kosher it. Now, how you kosher it is the trick. Because if you consider it to be, if you consider Cholav HaKompanis to be mutter, but just dairy, well, then there's one way to kosher it. It's a more lenient way to kosher it. But there are certain chumras that you have to do if you're considering it to be not kosher, and you're going from a dairy, not kosher, Cholav Stam item to parv. So what we do at the OU is, even though on the one hand we do rely on Rav Moshe's Kula and we do certify things that are Cholav Stam, Cholav HaKompanis, on the other hand, when going from dairy to parv, we're careful to always try to kosher it in a way that would satisfy those that consider Cholav HaKompanis to be not kosher as well. And that way we are able to be able to serve all those different groups and to be able to work for as much of Klal Yisrael as possible. And while we're on the subject of Rav Moshe's Heter, I wanted just a couple of exceptions that might exist to Rav Moshe's Heter. People aren't necessarily so used to it. We're so used to thinking that milk is mutter, no matter where you get it from. People aren't necessarily used to thinking that there may be some exceptions. There are some people who get milk direct from a farm. For allergen reasons, or they're back to nature types, or for whatever other reasons they do this, there's a middleman who goes to a farm, buys some unpasteurized milk, and like an old-time milkman, distributes it to a few different people in the big city. And it's not pasteurized. And it's not really legal to sell not pasteurized milk to a consumer, which means that the whole thing is under the radar. It's under the table, which means you don't have any more the oversight of any government agencies on the milk that you're purchasing from this farm. And if there's no Jew overseeing the chaliva, the milking, you don't have Cholav HaKompanis anymore. You got Cholav HaKom. So that's a very serious issue that there are, I don't know if there's anyone here who does that. I know some people who are Shomrei Torah, Shomrei Kashers, that were purchasing the stuff without thinking about it. And we had a conversation. They had to go and ask the Rav, whatever the Rav says. But it's something to think about. It's a possible exception to Rav Moshe's Heter. Another one that came up recently is colostrum. Colostrum, of course, is the first couple of milkings after the cow has a calf. The first couple of milkings is called colostrum. And that milk has different nutritional properties than regular milk. And the question is, it arose recently in our office because it's coming up. People are there are companies including it in products, and it's even used sometimes as a supplement. You could buy a powdered colostrum product from I don't know if GNC, but some of these places they sell that type of a thing, a powdered colostrum product. The question is that covered by Rav Moshe's Heter? Now, halachically, there really shouldn't be a difference between colostrum and milk. Milk is milk; it's all the same thing. Just because the nutrients are different, it shouldn't make a difference. However, what we discovered when we were researching it is that the U.S. government does make a difference between milk and colostrum. They don't regulate it the same way. And so the oversight over milk, where a government, if they found out that you were adulterating milk and adding porcine milk to your bovine milk, that they would fine you, it's not true for colostrum. And so it's not so clear that colostrum, if you were to buy colostrum, that would satisfy Rav Moshe's requirements of Cholav HaKompanis. That's at least true for the U.S. We found, I was working with a company in New Zealand where it looked from what we could tell that in New Zealand they were regulating it the same way. So perhaps colostrum in New Zealand may be one thing and colostrum in America may not be allowed. But again, that's where people who rely on the heter are so used to thinking that all milk is going to be okay. It's not necessarily true. And that gets me to the next point, which somebody in this room is for sure going to ask me, so I'll get rid of it before you ask. I get this all the time. Can I buy milk anywhere I go without an OU? Does milk need an OU? So the short answer is, yeah, you can buy it anywhere without an OU. But you're all sitting here for the last 2 hours. You're not interested in the short answer, so you're stuck with the long one. The long answer is that, you know how we said that the same plant that produces milk is also bottling orange juice. And if they're bottling orange juice, they're really probably also bottling grape juice. And grape juice is probably stam yenem, and it's probably usser. Which means that there are many dairies out there. Dairies don't refer to the farm. When I say dairy, that means the factory that's producing the milk. It's pasteurizing it and bottling it. So there are many factories out there making milk, and they're also making all sorts of other things that are questionable. Now, 99.9% of the cases, it's all going to be okay. It's all going to be kosher b'dieved. They'll either do some kind of koshering that's okay b'dieved, or for various reasons it'll be okay. So the short answer was yes. But the long answer is that if you've got one product right next to the other, one does not have an OUD and one does, I would definitely prefer the one with the OUD. And that's especially true. They sell these milks that can be kept on the shelf. They don't have to be refrigerated in a rectangular Tetra Pak package. Now, Tetra Pak processing is very sensitive because you're putting milk, you're sending milk, and it's not going in the fridge. So you got to be very careful with that stuff. And it's very rare, actually, relatively rare, to have a company that has a Tetra Pak processor. There aren't so many of them relative to regular dairies. And so if you've got milk in one of those rectangular, non-refrigerated packages, the odds are very high that they're using it for some other stuff. In fact, I have a company that I work with on a regular basis. We have to kosher all the time because they make chicken soup. And right after they make the chicken soup, they make milk. And so we got to make sure the koshering's done all right. And there are some places, I know another place that does a Tetra Pak. If I'm making a beef soup, where am I going to go? There are only a certain number of places that have this kind of packaging, so I got to go to a dairy. So they're making a beef soup, all nevela, all totally treif, and then they're making chalav, perhaps basar b'chalav. So the short answer was yes, the long answer is you got to be a little bit more careful. But one final thing is cream, half and half cream, what you're using for your coffee. That's not necessarily going to be kosher. And that's because cream back in the old days meant that you took your milk, you separated it to make 1% or 2%, and the fat that came off of it would be cream, and you'd add that to your coffee, and it would taste great. Nowadays, cream isn't necessarily coming straight from milk. Cream can come from cheese production. And contrary to what some rogue operators may tell you, Rav Moshe never, although he matured something called Cholav Akum, he never matured anything called Gvinas Akum. The Shulchan Aruch says that Gvinas Akum is forbidden. That means cheese made by a non-Jew. And the most popular reason for that is because back in the day they might use a calf stomach lining, because you have to add something to the milk to make the proteins clump together to form a cheese. So what they would use, stomach linings are really good for that. And they would take a calf stomach lining to do that, which would make your cheese absolutely not kosher. So Chazal came along and said, all gvina, all cheese made by a non-Jew, not in the presence of a non-Jew, according to the Ramah, is not kosher. Now, when you make cheese, you know, little Miss Muffet sat on her tuffet eating curds and whey. So she ate, what you do when you make cheese is you're taking your curds, you're sticking them together, and the whey is the liquid that drains off. And in that whey liquid, you can also make cream from that. And so nowadays, when you see cream, you don't necessarily see a product that's taken off of the milk and is kosher under Rav Moshe's Heter, but you see perhaps cream that's taken off of whey and may, depending on how it's made, be absolutely not kosher. And so you can no longer necessarily just go into a coffee shop and eat a half and take half and half or a cream and put it into your coffee. So just on the subject of Gvina Sakum, and I'm all done. How do we make kosher cheese nowadays? If cheese has to be made with a Jew either there or putting in that item, how do we do it? There are two different types of cheeses, two different ways to make cheese. One way is like a calf rennet. You take something in there, you put something in there. It can be a rennet from a calf, or it could be something called microbial rennet, which isn't a kosher item. And you add it to the milk. The proteins kind of grab each other, trap some fat in there, and you make a cheese. That's one way. And that's what Chazal were referring to when they said that Gvinas Akum is forbidden. Rav Henkin has a tshuva, and he has a psak anyway. And this is pretty much the minhag in America, is to say that when the Gemara said that gvinas akum is forbidden, it was referring to that kind of cheese. But there's another way to make cheese also. And that is, instead of adding something to the milk that causes the proteins to glob together, you change the pH of the milk. And you add an acid to it to acidify the milk. And when you do that, the proteins fall out of solution. They don't necessarily grab each other, but they kind of join together in a little corner. And it's a less compact cheese. It's not like a mozzarella or a cheddar, which are really hard. It's more like a cottage cheese would qualify. Cottage cheese, farmer's cheese, according to some, even a sour cream and a yogurt, Russian tvorog. There are all sorts of different cheeses that are made like that. And the minhag in America, based on Rav Henkin, is that that kind of cheese is not a cheese as defined by the Gemara. So that was mutter even without a rabbi. But in order to make a mozzarella and a cheddar and all those hard cheeses, the provolone, those need a rabbi present. And so we do have a rabbi present in most cases actually adding the microbial rennet, in some cases watching as the Gentile worker adds the microbial rennet, and that's how we manage to stock the shelves with OUD and sometimes OUD Chol of Yisrael cheeses. It takes a lot of work. We can need a rabbi there, and it can cost a lot also. We got to pay somebody to be there for days at a time. This is a very long run. He's got to be there for a whole lot of time. That's what it takes so that you can have your pizza, and that's what we're going to do for you.
Okay, due to the lateness of the hour, we want to still take some final question and answers. So Ray Price said he would compress, coagulate his drasha. We appreciate it, but he's going to try to squeeze it in.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Grossman. And I just, on behalf of everyone here, we want to thank everyone for coming because we thank you, of course, for your interest, but the more people express their interest and are focused on what we do, it raises our conscientiousness. I mean, hopefully we're always conscientious, but it's always important to see the people and to understand that people care. So we appreciate that. I'm in the ingredients department, and one of the other speakers, Rabbi Jenkins, spoke about Rabbi Jurabel, and we have a small department where anytime a company uses an ingredient, all of their ingredients have to be approved, and we, one of the things that we constantly inform the companies is before they purchase, before the purchasing agents all have to be aware that before an ingredient is purchased or even considered, it has to be vetted by the OU and approved and put on something called the Schedule A, where the catalog of ingredients is that's the catalog of approved ingredients for the company. So one of our jobs is the companies are always asking for new ingredients, whether they're ingredients under the OU, from other OU companies, or under other hashkachas, and a large quantity of the time, or a lot of the time, there's no hashkacha on these ingredients whatsoever. So one of the determinations we have to make is whether the ingredient needs hashkacha at all. And there's a large body of ingredients that don't need any hashkacha. And our job is to constantly review that and to confirm whether the status of the ingredient remains the same. One of the questions that recently came up, and it was just it's actually an old question, but our reconsideration was recent. The Shaila came to the office a couple weeks ago. Actually, a Rav directed the person to call the office. The person wanted to serve papaya at a Sanam event. And the person was a little paralyzed by the following question, that papaya, generally speaking, is the way papaya is harvested, is always harvested within, or typically harvested within the first 3 years of the birth of this plant, of the papaya tree. And the person wasn't sure if papaya, since that's the derech, is okay. And the background to the question is that there's a halach of arla, and arla we usually associate as an iser from Eretz Yisrael, and that's what the pasuk says. The pasuk in Vayikra says that it's pretty clear that it seems to be limited in Eretz Yisrael. Gemara in Kedushin says that it's a halach lamoshe Sinai, that arla in chutz la'aretz is also aser. And it's, of course, as we know, is Isra Varla arises when fruit is born in the first 3 years of the tree. So the person was concerned about serving papaya, And to just enlarge this question, we had thought about this question before, because there's not just the Yisr of Papaya, but or the Shaila, I should say, of Papaya, but in one of the popular, something more popular than just papaya. Most of us in this room probably don't encounter papaya that often, but an important and somewhat ubiquitous food ingredient is something called papayan. And in the Congo and in other parts of the world, lots of papayas are harvested, and they will make an incision on the klipa of the papaya, and will pull out something that looks like it's like a latex type of substance, which is an enzyme. This enzyme has quite a few different uses. It's used to tenderize meat, and it's used. Many of the Hamish pharmaceutical companies or dietary supplement companies use it for digestion. And it's used as a clarifier in juices, and we have, I looked at our computer, we have 85 different OU products which are containing or either have papayan in them, or papayan itself is the product. And so it's not just a question which is limited to these catering events, but it's quite matzli, it's quite ubiquitous in our, whether we know it or not, it's probably something that we encounter in the foods we eat. So part of the question here is the Metzias question: is it universally harvested within the first 3 years? And there was we actually have a representative in Europe who went down to the Congo a few years ago, because we have papayan companies, which are Belgian companies. Belgium had the Congo was a colony at one point, and so that's the origin of why Belgian companies sell papayan. But I don't think it's a colony anymore, but they still, you know, have roots in the Congo. So he went down to the Congo to see this, and he sort of confirmed that they were typically, if not almost always, harvested within the first 3 years. Now let me just explain the metzias of how the papaya tree grows. It grows quite quickly off the out, and it goes, I guess, within the first year, it grows to 8 feet, and it starts to bear fruit. And the fruit, interestingly enough, comes from the stalk, I guess, itself, the stump. It doesn't come from a nuffin. Typically, fruit trees, there are these branches that come out. But this comes out, and these beautiful fruits come off. And on top of the fruits, there are these big branches that come, like lulavim type things that come out. And it bears fruit within the first year. In the second year, it goes already to 16 feet, and more fruits come from that higher point which it grows. The papaya fruits always come from this higher point. And then they pick it, and then the third year it's already at 25 feet, and they pick it, and typically, because it gets so it grows so rapidly, they abandon the tree after the first 3 years. It will continue to grow for 4 or 5 years, in which case the quality goes down. Anyway, the whole question really here is, part of the question is that it could be that there are certain cases. The halacha is that sveiko mutter and sveiko is mutter and vada yasser. And the way that many of the achronim understand the halacha of orlan chutzlaret is that even if there's a small possibility, even if it's not a sefek ashakel, but if there's a small possibility that it'll be from outside of the third, from after the third year, then it's acceptable. That's one pesach to assume that the fruits are all okay. But the more substantive reason, and the reason why the pesach is that it's all mutter, is because there's a machlokes on what's considered a tree. What's the definition of a tree? So although the standard definition that we're familiar with, that's brought in the most of the Kitzur Hilchos Brachos books, is that if it sheds its, if the stump goes away or needs to be replanted from year to year, if it sheds itself and then regrows every year, so that is what a tree is. But there's another definition of a tree, which Rashi brings, it's also brought in the Beis Yosef brings, is that if it has to come from the anafim of the tree, and if the fruit comes from the anafim, that's a criterion in a fruit, in a fruit tree, and whether you make a Bori Priya Eitz or Bori Priya Damos, whether it comes from the anafim or not. And seems to be a machlekes whether this would be properly called a Bori Priya Eitz or Bori Priya Dama. The Gedarim for Brachos is really virtually the same Gedarim for this definition of tree as it relates to the concept of the Isra of Orla. Because it seems to be a machlekes, and seems there's no it's a sveik of the dinner. There's some Rav Sternbach and others write that a sveik of the dinner will also constitute an adequate suffix for Orlan Chutz Laaretz, and it's a genuine suffix. And the Rebelski and the Schechter have maskim to this mahalach, and as a result, papaya and papayan is acceptable. So,
great. Okay, this is just a short glimpse into what goes into ingredients that we would never think of that are used in our daily things that we eat. Okay, we have a lot of questions. We'll try to do it very quickly. Some we may have to leave over for next week, but let's see as many as we can get done here. This is for Rabbi Merzel. What is, I think two questions go together. What is the status of Cholov Stam milk, dairy products out of the USA, such as in Asia? And similar questions, milk outside the U.S. problematic in Europe?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, because as we said, it does depend on, you know, the status of the government oversight in each country. Currently, we are accepting dairy products from Europe, from India. There are cases where we wouldn't necessarily accept it. You know, we had to review recently places like China, where it might not be.
With a quick review.
Where it might not be acceptable. So yeah, it depends on the country. Currently, we are accepting from Europe.
I don't know who would like to answer this question. Does the OU rely on foreign hashgachas? I think the answer is that they meet our standards. We do. Okay. What happened to Rabbi Merzel? What happened to OUDE?